There have been few American public servants as admired as Leon Panetta. At the age of 70, when he might have thought his stellar career was drawing to a close, Barack Obama made him director of the CIA. 2 years later, Panetta was appointed Secretary of Defense, and then he retired just 2 years ago. All of this coming at the end of a career which started in Richard Nixon's administration. Panetta then spent four decades with the Democrats, including 16 years in Congress and a stint as Bill Clinton's White House Chief of Staff and Budget Chief. I spoke yesterday to Leon Panetta and first asked him about the topmost priority he was given by President Obama: find and capture or kill Osama bin Laden. Did he see that as a mission impossible?
Well, frankly, it seemed that way at the time because there were absolutely no hints of evidence as to where he might be located. It had been almost a 10-year search. Most of the trails of evidence had led to nowhere. And so it was a situation in which, frankly, there was very little to go on. But the president did want me to make that a priority, and I wanted it to make a priority as director of the CIA, and had a chance then to sit down with the people at CIA and ask what was going on, and they basically told me that there just was not much there. And I said, well, we've got to put together a team of people that will focus on nothing else but this and try to develop whatever sources of information they can. And fortunately, they were able to do that.
How long did it take before you got any kind of significant breakthrough?
Oh, it took probably about a year of looking at all kinds of possible ways to see if we could locate him. At one point, we thought we would follow members of his family who were in Iran. They were actually in house arrest in Iran, and Iran was releasing some of them, and we thought that might be one way to try to see if we could follow them and that they might lead us to bin Laden's compound, but that didn't work out. We tried some technological ways to try to see if we could work to determine exactly where he might be located and using his computers, and that didn't pan out. But then we found evidence of who the couriers were to bin Laden. That was something we had focused on. I had no idea what their names were, who they were, and gradually we were able to piece together intelligence that defined who they were, but put a name to the couriers, and then we were able to put a face to the name and then located that individual in a town called Peshawar in Pakistan. And when we were able to do that and follow them to where they went, they're the ones that led us to ultimately the bin Laden compound.
The word fortress, I think, was used to you in a briefing which made your ears prick up. That was ultimately where you sent in with the authority, or where the president decided on your advice and those of your colleagues in the CIA to send in that group of SEALs at the last weekend in April in 2011, I think it was. How certain were you, though, that you had the right man at that stage?
Well, we never really had 100% evidence that he was there. As you pointed out, when we saw the compound, it was unusual. It had 18-foot walls on one side, 12-foot walls on another side. It even had about an 8-foot wall on the third-floor balcony, which was very strange. So it was they were using high security. We were able to identify the number of members of the family by looking at the clothes on the clothesline in the compound, and the number of family members matched the bin Laden family. We also saw this individual who walked rapidly almost each day like a prisoner in a prison yard, came out, walked a number of times around in circles. And we tried to get the identity of that individual, but were unable to do so. But nevertheless, we kind of pieced together little bits and pieces of intelligence that gave us at least the best case we had on bin Laden since finding him at Tora Bora, which was over 10 years before that. So the president obviously decided that You know, we had to develop an operation. We looked at several ways to do this. I think at one point we looked at just bombing the hell out of the place with a B-2 bomber, but that frankly would cause damage to villages nearby, so we couldn't do that. We looked at the possibility of using a drone, and then finally just settled on the SEAL teams going in on a commando raid, which seemed to make the most sense. But I do have to tell you, when it was brought to the National Security Council, many people in that room thought it was too risky because we really didn't know, and because the Pakistanis might cause trouble. But there were a few of us that thought that we really did have to move on the information we had, and that we would regret it if we didn't. And secondly, frankly, I had a tremendous amount of confidence in the ability of the SEALs to conduct that operation. Ultimately, the president made that decision.
And yet, it was not a mission that passed off without a hitch. There were serious problems encountered just as they reached that compound.
That's right. And that made a lot of people nervous, including me. I was heading up the operation from the CIA, and we were following it. And what happens with helicopters is that if it's been a warm day, a hot day, and it's a confined area, as it was over that compound, the mission was that the helicopters would go in and basically so-called repel the SEALs down a rope into the middle of that compound and onto the roof. That was the design of the plan. But when they got there, one of the helicopters, because it had been hot that day, the heat came up and basically stalled the engine. And thanks to some great capability on the part of the pilot, he settled the helicopter down. The tail caught on a wall, but he was able to settle it down, thank God. And when I asked Admiral McRaven, who headed up that mission, what's going on, he really didn't miss a beat. He said, no problem. We've got a backup helicopter coming in. They're going to continue with the mission, which they did. They breached through the walls of the compound, went in, conducted that mission, and obviously were successful going after bin Laden.
Clearly, it was important that you be able to prove afterwards through DNA and samples and so forth that it was bin Laden that had been killed and then subsequently buried at sea. You're very laudatory, I suppose, of Barack Obama for the way he decisively dealt with that, and also his insistence that there be a backup plan, which was in fact used. But maybe you're less complimentary then towards the president in the way he has conducted some of his international affairs, particularly, say, in regard to not insisting or not following your own advice that there be at least a small residual American force left behind in Iraq, that you're now paying a price for that.
Well, you know, as I point out in the book, the president obviously was very courageous in making that decision on bin Laden, and actually supported a lot of the operations that that we had recommended to him, both when I was CIA director and Secretary of Defense. As always with presidents, there are areas where you have some disagreements, and one of those, frankly, was on the importance of maintaining a force in Iraq, which I think was very important. We had come a long way with the Iraqis. We had developed their security capability. We had helped them establish at least the institutions of government to try to see if they could bring that country together. But I think it was important to continue to maintain a presence there in order to support that security apparatus and in order to continue to put pressure on Maliki to head in the right direction. I mean, let's make no mistake about it. The primary cause of what happened there is Prime Minister Maliki, who resisted our having a presence, then once we left, obviously became very sectarian. Forced the Sunnis out of the government, forced the Sunnis out of the military. And I think ultimately all of that combined is what led to the creation of ISIS.
Yes, but I'm wondering, Secretary Panetta, would a small force, as recommended by yourself and colleagues, would it have prevented the collapse of the Iraqi army or the advance of the Islamic State?
Well, Sean, you ask a question that I guess nobody really will ever know the answer to. I mean, you never know how history plays out. And yet I do think that we would have probably had a better chance had we had a presence there to continue to look at the security forces, continue to try to maintain their ability to secure that country. But more importantly, I think we would have had greater leverage on Maliki to force him in the right direction in terms of the decisions that he should have made as prime minister in order to try to keep that country together. But, you know, would he have resisted it? Would he have gone his own way no matter what we did? It's hard to say.
You suggest as well that in Syria that the president sent mixed signals by suggesting that the use of chemical weapons by Bashar al-Assad would effectively cross a red line, but then he did nothing about it when that eventuality unfolded. Now, I suppose the question might be asked, you know, if he were to take action against Assad or arm his opponents, which ones would he have armed?
Well, that's I think that's the question. Obviously, Syria was total chaos. It was a disaster in terms of the numbers of Syrians who were dying and those that had to basically leave that country as refugees because of what was going on. And the real problem is that, you know, there were probably about 100 different elements to the opposition. And when David Petraeus at CIA made the recommendation that we should try to train and arm one of those groups, I think the point was to try to determine who were the more moderate forces in the opposition, support them, train them, and try to make them an effective force, not only at trying to unify the opposition, but an effective force at going after Assad. That was the point of trying to do that. And, you know, look, I think the president, to his credit, you know, has made the decision that it is important to do that now. He is going to be training and arming elements of the opposition, which I think is the right decision. And I thought it was something we should have done probably 2 years ago.
So at this stage, after over a decade of war, be it in Iraq or in Afghanistan, where do you assess or how do you assess or rate the security of the United States? Are you safer now than you were pre 9/11?
Well, you know, I do think that as a result of 9/11 and as the result of al-Qaeda attacking our country and killing over 3,000 people, that a decision was made that we had to go to war against against al-Qaeda for what they did. And we did. And we went after them, went after their leadership in Pakistan, and I think did a pretty effective job at you know, not only going after bin Laden, but going after other leaders there. And basically the impact of that was that we really did prevent them from being able to design another 9/11 attack, which is something that they wanted to do. So to that extent, to the fact that we've been able to stop them from conducting another 9/11 type attack on this country, I think this country is safer. To the extent that there are now, you know, other terrorists like ISIS who want to conduct the same kinds of attacks on our country, then I think the bottom line is we still have a huge task ahead of us to be able to effectively go after those terrorists and make sure that, as the president has said, that not only do we disrupt them, but that we ultimately defeat them.
But given the reluctance of the American people to see boots on the ground, you know, as we saw in Afghanistan and in Iraq, how do you fight on those different battlefronts?
Well, you know, my view is that we've learned a lot over these over 10 years since 9/11 in terms of how we go after these terrorists. And, you know, our counterterrorism operations, the ability to, through intelligence, locate their leadership and then go after them and use our special forces in that process, I think has been extremely effective. And I guess what I would say is that we ought to use that kind of approach along, hopefully, with other countries to go after the threat from ISIS, to go after Boko Haram, to go after al-Shabaab in Somalia, to go after all of those al-Qaeda type organizations that have as their main mission ultimately attacking not only the United States but Europe and other countries. The American people, I think, recognize that they are a threat. I do think that the American people believe that we have a responsibility to protect them and to protect our country. Obviously they don't want to see us invade another country and deploy another 150,000 troops as we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. But having said that, I think they also understand that we have to take necessary action to be able to defeat ISIS and to make sure that they do not represent a threat to this country. So I think there are effective ways to get that mission done. I think the president has made a number of the right decisions in terms of going after them. But I do think that this country has to be committed to a very comprehensive effort in the war on terrorism. It's not going to end tomorrow. It's not going to end the next day. But ultimately, if we stick with it, I think we can ultimately achieve the victory that we need to achieve.
As we speak, news has broken of the departure of your successor as Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. How do you interpret that? Does it suggest that there's a division or lack of direction at the top?
I don't know. It's always hard to know just exactly what dynamic was involved here. I have to take the secretary at his word. He indicated that it was time for him to resign and submitted his resignation. And I guess I understand that. Those are tough jobs, and they take a lot out of you. So, I have to operate based on his word as to, what the relationship was like and what conflicts they may have had. I guess I'll let history ultimately look at that issue and decide.
More generally, looking at Barack Obama, the politician, you say in the book that he's too reticent to engage opponents, that the logic of the law professor rather than the passion of a leader is what comes into play. And how do you think that has damaged him? Does it account, for instance, for the fact that his poll ratings right now are very, very low?
Well, obviously there's a real concern in this country with the dysfunction in Washington, what I think the American people sense is that for a lot of reasons the president and the leadership in the Congress are just finding it very difficult to be able to work together to solve the problems that face this country, and we're facing a lot of problems that have not been effectively addressed as they should be by both Democrats and Republicans. And so what you have is a situation in which, as a result of this political gridlock, we are not dealing with effectively with immigration reform. The president had to go his own way, and Congress still trying to decide what they do. We haven't dealt with funding for infrastructure. We haven't dealt with the budget crisis that we're facing in this country. We haven't dealt with the whole issue of energy as effectively as we should, climate change. We haven't dealt with questions related to trade. I mean, there are a number of issues that have not been addressed. And the result is that people are angry, angry at Washington, angry at the president. And a lot of that showed in the last election.
With the possible exception of Hillary Clinton, and perhaps you're in a position to be more objective than she might be, and maybe more frank, I can't think of anybody better placed to assess the style and the modus operandi of the current Democratic president, President Obama, and Bill Clinton, because you worked, obviously, as not just a chief of staff in the Clinton administration, you were also head of the Office of Management and Budget in his early period. So how do you compare and contrast Clinton and Obama?
Well, they obviously were both very, very bright, very capable people. I mean, I think briefing both of them on complex issues was easy because they have fine minds and they can understand the most complex issues. They ask good questions, and frankly, I think in their heart, You know, both presidents wanted to do the right thing for the country. I think the difference is in terms of engaging in the political process. And Bill Clinton loved politics. You know, came to the presidency as governor, had to work with you know, both Republicans and Democrats back in Arkansas, and he brought that capability to Washington, and that you know, that love of politics, love of you know, basically engaging with people in the political process, that I think you know, even though he lost the Congress midway through his first term, he still nevertheless rolled up his sleeves and engaged with Newt Gingrich and tried to you know, develop some legislation, you know, some key legislation like welfare reform. Budget issues were agreed to, and other steps were taken. I think President Obama doesn't have that kind of you know, deep experience in terms of kind of the political process, and I think he had hoped that if he took the right positions, that the Republicans would be good enough to, you know, to be able to embrace them, work with the Democrats, and get it done. And the problem with Washington is if you don't roll up your sleeves and engage in that battle yourself and really try to push the process, it isn't going to happen. You know, governing is tough business. But, you know, as we saw even in that movie on Lincoln, when Lincoln wanted to pass the 13th Amendment, he had to go after every vote he could to be able to make sure that that happened. And that's the nature of governing.
By the way, before you got that call to join the Obama administration, at the age of 70, did you believe that your best days were behind you at that stage?
Well, you know, I loved being back home in California. We've established a Institute for Public Policy to try to encourage young people to get involved, and I was working at that and enjoying that. And you know, I had a pretty good life. But I also, you know, throughout my life, when the call for public service came, I've always responded to it. So when the president did call, you know, I responded because I thought it was another challenge in terms of helping to serve my country. And my parents, who, you know, benefited a lot from this country, always said to both myself and my brother that because of what this country gave them, we owed something back to this country, and I believe that.
And age was no barrier.
That's right.
Leon Panetta, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us on the program.
All right, Sean. Good to talk to you.
And we recorded that conversation last evening. He was speaking from his home in Monterey in California. The book is called Worthy Fights. It's his memoir. It's published by Penguin. I'm not sure it's available on this side of the Atlantic. It sells on the other side for about $35. Of course, you can always download it if you have a Kindle or a similar app. We'll be talking about fetal screening after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.